Today, repos, SLRs and other financial animals. The DFA Daily to the 20th of March 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance and Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we'll look at the latest announcements from the Fed and how it impacted the bond market and what happens when the mortgage repayment holidays end, RBA policy and its critics, and the weaknesses in our financial regulators, as well as our normal market update. So let's get started. As expected, the Federal Reserve came out with a brief release saying that the temporary change to its supplementary leverage ratio, or SLR, for bank holding companies will expire as scheduled on the 31st of March. This, of course, was something I've been discussing over the last few days, and my hypothesis is that it's connected with recent dynamics in the bond market. Additionally, they said the board will shortly seek comment on measures to adjust the SLR. The board will take appropriate actions to assure that any changes to the SLR does not erode the overall strength of bank capital requirements. To ease strains in the treasury market resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic and to promote lending to households and businesses, the board had temporarily modified the SLR last year to exclude US treasury securities and central bank reserves. Since then, the treasury market has stabilized. However, because of recent growth in the supply of central bank reserves and the issuance of treasury securities, the board may need to address the current design and calibration of the SLR over time to prevent strains from developing that could both constrain economic growth and undermine financial stability. To ensure that the SLR, which was established in 2014 as an additional capital requirement, remains effective, in an environment of higher reserves, the board will soon be inviting public comment on several potential SLR modifications. The proposal on comments will contribute to ongoing discussions with the Department of the Treasury and other regulators on future work to ensure the resiliency of the treasury market. Now, interestingly, of course, there is now a need for the banks to buy more bonds. On the other hand, the Treasury and the Fed need to sell more bonds, so that's a win-win for them, just reinforcing the connectivity between the supply and the demand side of the bond equation. But of course, the question is, what is the impact on the real economy? That's a discussion for another day. Now, Bloomberg said that the Federal Reserve would let a significant capital break for big banks expire at month's end, denying frenzied requests from Wall Street. In response to the pandemic, the Fed had let lenders load up on treasuries and deposits without setting aside capital to protect against losses. That relief will lapse on the 31st of March as planned, the Fed said. Though the regulator concluded the threat that COVID-19 poses to the economy isn't nearly as severe as a year ago, the Fed also said it will soon propose new changes to the so-called supplemental leverage ratio, or SLR. The goal is to address the spike in bank reserves triggered by the government's stimulus programs. The expiration of the temporary capital break may disappoint banks and bond traders, as many industry analysts had wanted the Fed to extend the deadline for at least a few months, especially since the $21 trillion Treasury market has recently been so volatile. Treasury dealers had already been exiting the market at a rapid clip. More than $80 billion was pulled in the last 2 weeks in advance of the central bank's decision. But the Fed officials believe the market is sufficiently stable and banks' capital is high enough to return to the pre-pandemic requirement, while the agency considers long-term changes. The biggest banks have nearly $1 trillion in capital, meaning they are already above the $800 billion that they would have needed to comply with the full SLR, according to Fed estimates. And lenders themselves will have to decide how much they want to exceed the agency's minimum requirement. With the Fed declaring banks to be well capitalized, there's a chance it will no longer be able to justify its pandemic-spurred constraints on dividends. And while the regulator already relaxed an earlier ban on stock buybacks, it's still restricting shareholder payments. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said this week that a decision is coming soon on dividends. This takes out of play the biggest political impediments to the Fed removing all COVID-19 related restrictions on big bank capital distributions, Jared Steinberg, an analyst at Cohen & Co, wrote in a Friday note. The Fed could drop its remaining constraints this year, he predicted. Central bank officials provided no details on the permanent modifications they propose to the SLR, but they did say they didn't want the industry's overall capital levels to change. The Fed added that it would work with the other banking agencies, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. These regulators also announced on Friday that they will let the temporary relief end on March the 31st. The agency's decisions mean big banks such as JP Morgan Chase & Co and Citigroup and Bank of America Corp must soon return to their customary SLR. That's a measure of their capital against all their assets. It's a mistake, Priya Misra, global head of rates strategy at TD Securities, said in a Bloomberg TV interview. I don't think the market was ready for this relief to be removed. The bank index fell 1% in New York, with all but one of the 24 companies in the index slumping. JP Morgan declined 2.7%, the biggest drop in the index, followed by Wells Fargo at 2.2%. The 10-year Treasury yield rose after the announcement, as many Wall Street strategists speculate the end of the regulatory break will induce some banks to shed treasuries. The benchmark borrowing rate hovers around 1.75%. The Fed did provide, though, another recent consolation by more than doubling to $80 billion the maximum overnight reverse repo activity a participant can execute through the central bank's facility. That would absorb some of the pressure of too much government stimulus cash sloshing through the system by giving money market funds a place to put it. So they do continue to manipulate the market pretty heavily. As Credit Suisse Group's Zoltan Pozsar put it this week, the Fed is foaming the runway to deal with the stress of going back to the existing leverage rule by giving banks an additional ability to direct deposits into money market funds. Fed officials said on Friday that the move was a monetary policy decision and not directly related to the leverage limit. But of course they would say that, wouldn't they? For the past year, that relaxed leverage cap has allowed the lenders to take on as much as $600 billion in extra reserves and treasuries without bumping up their capital demand. The bank could now be under pressure to shed some of those assets or seek more capital, which of course is costly. JP Morgan said it might consider turning away certain deposits as a result, and some treasury market strategists expect a hit to the market as the biggest lenders potentially sell holdings. The Fed faced intense political pressure from Democrat lawmakers, including Senate Banking Committee Chairman Sherrod Brown and Senator Elizabeth Warren, to let the capital break lapse on March the 31st. While Democrats lauded Friday's announcement, they will likely scrutinize the agency about its decision to propose permanent changes to the SLR. In a February 26th letter to the Fed, Brown and Warren called it one of the most important post-crisis regulatory reforms. And Brown said in a statement on Friday that ending the break is a victory for lending in communities hit hard by the pandemic. And in a message on Twitter, Warren called it the right decision for keeping our banking system strong. Ira Jersey, a rate strategist for Bloomberg's Intelligence, predicted regulators will eventually let banks exclude reserves from the SLR calculations, but not treasuries. Wall Street had been lobbying very hard for an extension of the exemptions, and banks have been flooded with deposits that require them to hold offsetting capital against customer money. It is surprising, you can see it to some degree from the market's reaction. I think some people figured if the Fed was going to kill it, they would at least give it more than 12 days, said Michael Schumacher, head of rate strategies at Wells Fargo. He noted that banks are bigger holders of five-year Treasury notes whose yield edged higher after the announcement. In deciding not to extend the SLR break, the Fed risks a further rise in interest rates, as banks may decide to sell some of their Treasury holdings if they don't have to maintain reserve requirements. Fed officials said the Treasury market has stabilized, and Friday's decision should not change that. However, Fed officials said banks are still well capitalized, even without the exception, and they don't believe banks will need to sell their treasuries to meet reserve requirements. The largest banks have about $1 trillion in capital, and rescinding the SLR relief will adjust those levels only marginally, Fed officials said. The supplemental leverage ratio is a product of post-Great Recession banking reforms that sought to make sure banks didn't take on too much risk. Federal officials worried that relaxing the ratio might encourage banks to load up on risky assets like junk bonds, which carry the same weight against reserve requirements as safer holdings. So this is not over yet, in my view, and it will be interesting to see what further moves they make and what happens to those bond rates. Because on one hand, banks might decide to not take so many deposits. On the other hand, they might decide that they need to buy more bonds. And depending on which way they go, they could move the market quite substantially. Now in New York, the Nasdaq steadied on Friday as the spike in Treasury yields subsided, paving the way for bargain-hunting investors to snap up growth stocks following a rout a day earlier. The 10-year Treasury yield, which trades inversely to prices, of course, retreated on Friday after hitting 1.75% on the Federal Reserve's announcement. The pullback from the highs in Treasury yields was overdue, as some analysts had noted rates look overstretched given their recent run. As noted yesterday, we think the TNX charts are due for a pullback to reduce overbought pressures, Janie Capital Montgomery said. But the overall trend here is still bullish, and firms expect the 10-year rate to possibly hit 2% this year. What we see today is a more stable rate environment across the curve after multiple weeks of rising interest rates, and we're seeing some degree of reversal of leadership in the equity market, said Bill Northey, Senior Investment Director at US Bank Wealth Management in Minneapolis. The action from the Fed and subsequent moves on yields dealt a blow to banking stocks, sending financials nearly 1% lower. Still, the retreat comes as financials have made strong starts this year, up by more than 16% during the last month. JP Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo led the declines, falling by more than 1%. Still, the retreat comes as financials have really been up more than 30% over the last month. In other news, Visa slumped 5% as the payments company is reported to be under investigation from the Justice Department for alleged anti-competitive practice in the debit card market, according to reports in Reuters. And the Dow fell for a second straight day on Friday, paced by a decline in bank stocks as bond yields retreated sharply from hitting more than one-year highs earlier this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.71%, and the S&P was down 0.07%, while the Nasdaq was up 0.76%. Facebook rallied 4.1% and provided the biggest boost to the Nasdaq and the S&P 500 after Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg said that Apple's imminent privacy policy changes on ad sales would leave the social network in a stronger position. And optimism about a $1.9 trillion fiscal package and the Fed's promise to maintain its ultra-loose policy stance for years accelerated a shift in economy-led stocks, powering the 500 and the Dow to record levels this week. But the Nasdaq is still about 6% below its February 12th all-time closing high, as technology and growth stocks have lost favour in recent months, and their valuations look less attractive as Treasury yields rise. For the week, the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq fell 0.8%, while the Dow lost 0.5%. And trading was orderly, despite Friday being quadruple witching. the once in the quarter simultaneous expiration of various derivatives, which often spurs heavy trading volumes and some volatility. And volumes on the US exchanges were 16.5 billion shares, compared with the 14.4 billion average for the full session over the last 20 trading days. In the US, the Dow Jones was down 0.71% to 32,628. The S&P 500 was down 0.06% to 3,913. And the S&P 500 Financials was up 0.56% to 573.52. The NASDAQ was up 0.76% to 13,215. And the volatility index was down 2.92% to 20.95. Goldman Sachs was down 1.09% to 344.20. Google was up 0.28% to 2,026. Amazon was up 1.55% to 3,074. And Apple was down 0.45% to 119.99. Facebook was up 4.12% to 290.11. And Boeing was down 0.09% to 255.82. While GE was down 0.23% to 1322. And Intel was up 0.05% to 63.76. While GameStop was down 0.73% to 227. The long bond, the 30-year, was down 0.56% to 2.437. The 10-year was down 0.12% to 1.73. And the 3-year was up 1.64% to 0.334. While the 1 month was 1% higher at 0.010. The dollar index was down 0.13% to 91.74. Over in the UK, the FTSE was down 0.05% to 6,708. The financial services index in the UK was down 1.09% to 805.82. And the Royal Bank of Scotland, NatWest, was up 0.47% to 191.40, while Metro Bank was down 2.25% to 115. The pound US dollar was down 0.32% to 1.3875. In Germany, the DAX was down 1.05% to 14,621, while the 10-year bond was up 2.21% to minus 0.287, and the 30-year bond was up 1.44% to 0.282. Deutsche Bank was down 3.6% to 10.74. The euro-US dollar was down 0.09% to 1.1904. And the Italian 2-year bond was down 1.94% to minus 0.386. In Japan, the Nikkei was down 1.41% to 29,792. The Shanghai Composite was down 1.69% to 3,404. And the US dollar yuan was up 0.06% to 6.5090. Gold was up 0.66% to 1,743. Silver was down 0.08% to 26.33. Copper was down 0.13% to 4.1025. And crude oil futures, again a volatile week, was up 2.43% to 61.46. The Stoxx 600 Global Index was down 0.75% to 423.63. The iShares Russell 2000 ETF was up 0.75% to 226.94. The S&P 500 futures was down 0.24% to 3,896. while the Nasdaq futures was up 0.37% to 12,827. And in crypto land, Ethereum was up 2.01% to 1,815, while Bitcoin, up near its highs again, was up 1.23% to 58,330. Now, back in Australia, tens of thousands of homeowners are expected to need ongoing support after pandemic mortgage holidays end next month. The nation's largest lender, CBA, revealed on Wednesday that some 25,000 households had yet to resume repayments at the end of January, with debt totaling $9 billion. Although it's far less than at the height of the pandemic, Commonwealth Bank CEO Matt Comyn said those still on mortgage holidays were likely to be among the bank's most vulnerable customers. Comyn told reporters it was reasonable to expect a large number would require further assistance beyond the program's scheduled end on March the 26th. And the other major banks have said something similar. Our plan is to continue to provide support. We're working very closely with customers, Comyn said during a media call. CBA has made about 250,000 calls to those on deferred loans to check how they're doing heading into the March 26th deadline. Other major banks, which haven't provided recent figures, were holding around 67,000 other deferred loans between them at the end of last year. Comyn said CBA wouldn't resume foreclosures until September at the earliest, but the reality is that some people would still be struggling when they did. It might not be viable for a subset of customers to continue to repay their loan, he conceded. There are options around restructuring a facility and potentially the sale of a property to reduce debt. Comyn expects many people still on mortgage holidays to require more support. It's a sobering reality that Financial Counselling Australia CEO Fiona Guthrie calls a terrible policy outcome. Some people might lose their homes because of a health crisis that's no fault of their own, she told the New Daily. There's a role for some sort of government support for these people. The good news, as with much in Australia at the moment, is that things could have been far worse, according to independent economist Saul Eslake. It's a much smaller problem than we thought, he told the New Daily. There's been a very rapid decline in mortgage deferrals, but that's the big picture story. At the household level, Eslake says many Australians would be doing whatever it took to keep paying off the mortgage, including cutting back on food and avoiding trips to the dentist. Fortunately, banks don't want to be landlords, though, and will avoid foreclosures wherever possible, Eslake said. And because households suffered less hardship than once feared, the banks will have more room to offer extra help. The banks can afford to be flexible without seriously impacting the overall quality of their mortgage book, Eslake said. Each of the major banks has a slightly different plan to ease customers back into repayments. National Australia Bank, which was carrying around 4,300 deferred loans late last year, said it will continue to offer repayment moratoriums. We'll provide support for those customers based on their individual circumstances, such as through reduced loan repayments, payment moratoriums and employment support, a spokesman said. However, deferrals extended beyond March 31 will affect a borrower's credit rating. ANZ, which is due to provide an update on deferrals later, said it will continue offering short-term repayment pauses. While entering into payment arrangements with customers, we seek to make sure they are sustainable and realistic, a spokesman said. And Westpac said it was looking at its options, which could include giving more time to customers to get their affairs in order. Customers with ongoing financial challenges will receive tailored support on a case-by-case basis. We look at a range of options as part of the process, a spokesman said, notwithstanding the promise of extra support. Ms. Guthrie urged homeowners worried about resuming repayments to get in touch with their banks and brush up on their rights. There's assistance available if you've had a loan deferred that's coming to an end. That doesn't mean you still don't have rights to ask for hardship assistance again, Guthrie said. If the creditor refuses to assist you, talk to an independent financial counsellor. According to Stephen Grenville in the AFR, the RBA is not responsible for the post-global financial slowdown. It's austerity. And he refers to Ross Garnaut and said, Ross Garnaut is wrong to fault the Reserve Bank for not cutting rates during the dog days of 2013-19. The real culprit was elsewhere. Ross Garnaut's reset provides another valuable contribution to the debate on Australia's post-COVID-19 future. But in reviewing the past, he misassesses macro policy in explaining what he calls the dog days of 2013-19. It was fiscal austerity, not monetary policy, that restrained growth in that period. Garnaut says monetary policy was too tight, missing the opportunity to get unemployment down to match the US. Other central banks adjusted more swiftly to the new lower costs of capital by lowering the interest rates that they control more than the Reserve Bank of Australia lowered the Australian policy rates. This caused the foreign exchange value of the Australian dollar to be higher than it would otherwise have been. In the 4 years following the 2008 global financial crisis, Australian interest rates were clearly higher than those in the US because the country had come through the GFC well, with no financial stability issues. GDP continued to grow at a reasonable pace, and inflation was at the high end of its 2-3% range. By 2013, commodity prices had fallen from their late 2011 peak. The real exchange rate followed commodity prices down, losing about 20% compared to the peak. The RBA's overnight cash rate was lowered quickly and substantially. True, Australia's policy rate was above America's, reflecting their very different global financial crisis experiences. Their financial sector collapsed. Emergency measures were needed in the form of a zero Fed funds rate, plus vigorous, unconventional monetary policies to prevent a 1930s-style collapse. Those crisis settings were still needed in 2013 because America's recovery was feeble, held back by the balance sheet legacy of the GFC. Should Australia have matched those emergency settings in our non-emergency environment to keep the exchange rate weaker than the market equilibrium? From 2013-19, the differential between the Australian and American policy rates averaged less than 1%, not enough to have had much effect on the exchange rate. If the objective was a lower exchange rate, it would have been more effective to push down the bond rate with our own QE. Foreign investors held 3/4 of our bonds and so were more sensitive to bond differentials rather than policy rates. Any competitive advantage from a lower parity rate would have come to a corresponding disadvantage to our trading partners, hence the strong international pressure not to attempt this kind of beggar-thy-neighbour policy. America is super sensitive to currency manipulation. The beggar thy neighbour policy that Garnaut advocates would have been hard to justify in a growing economy, albeit not fast enough to reduce unemployment as much as we would have all liked. COVID-19 provided a different environment for unconventional monetary policy. It requires a huge increase in the budget deficit with challenging funding needs. At the same time, banks had to cosset current borrowers with loan servicing forbearance. Lower borrowing costs for the government and banks was the sensible prescription. In these circumstances, no one could accuse the RBA of currency manipulation. In all of this discussion of growth rates, Garnaut neglects the role of fiscal policy. Australia's deficit was about 5% of GDP as the GFC unfolded. This was sensible. But then, over the 2013-19 period, the budget returned to near balance. It was still in deficit over this period, but its impact on growth comes from the change in the budget balance, which was unambiguously contractory. We can argue over the exact size of the budget multiplier, but since Olivia Blanchard's mea culpa about the IMF's underestimation of the multiplier in the post-GFC period, a multiplier of about 1.5 times seems sensible. Thus, on average over this period, budget austerity took nearly 1% off growth every year. Garnaut seems to endorse this austerity. In his 2013 book, he makes it clear that is the combination of tighter budgets and looser money that takes the dollar down. Some would argue that the austerity was needed to get the deficit down quickly to reload the fiscal cannon. But whatever your view is on this debate, it's hard to deny that austerity undermined growth. Meanwhile, monetary policy was pedalled to the metal, exercising a strong expansionary influence with spectacularly low interest rates. These rates were simultaneously driving a boom in asset prices, including dwellings and housing debt, and fiscal policy, on the other hand, was pulling hard on the reins. In praising America for doing better in this period, Garlow misses Donald Trump's ill-considered 2017 company tax reductions. This strong fiscal stimulus got US unemployment down to 3.5%, and it demonstrates the power of fiscal policy, but it means that the US began the COVID-19 crisis with a budget deficit of 5% of GDP and rising public debt. There is no need to follow that example, just aim for a sensible balance between monetary and fiscal policy. Now, Peter Tulip, ex-RBA, says Stephen Grenville is clever, but this op-ed shows what is wrong with the RBA. His key point is the RBA can't be blamed for errors of omission. Blame someone else. We didn't do anything, even though inflation and unemployment were veering off course. This avoidance of responsibility is why the RBA has a culture of inaction. It is why the RBA persistently misses its targets. For lower unemployment and more stable inflation, we need fundamental reform of the RBA. Yeah, well said, Peter Tulip. And Adele Ferguson also focuses in on regulatory inaction. She's an investigative journalist and wrote a column in The Age that says James Shipton from ASIC appeared in control in his first appearance at a parliamentary committee hearing since standing down, while an investigation is carried out into his relocation expenses. The last committee meeting was October, and Shipton didn't look like he would survive the year. But on Friday, he said he would stick around until a new leader was found, which could take months. Until then, ASIC is in a transition phase. Not surprisingly, the commissioners wanted to make it clear it was focused on a number of investigations, including Greensill Capital, which it began in November. Deputy Chair Karen Chester, who reconfirmed she had tipped her hat into the ring for the top jobs at ASIC, was looking at a number of areas related to the collapsed supply chain financier, including working with the prudential regulator, which she said was looking at Greensill's relationship with three insurers. In superannuation, he had 20 enforcement investigations on the go, 8 matters in litigation, and multiple surveillances about potential super trustee misconduct. And it was also in the throes of overhauling some important processes spawned from the Auditor General and Dr. Vivian Tom's review of ASIC's governance. It's clear that both the Auditor General and Dr. Thom identified some significant failures in ASIC's processes and procedures in managing relocation expenses for both myself and the former Deputy Chair, Mr. Daniel Crennan, Shipton said at the hearing. Changes include establishing an executive integrity committee with oversight of ASIC's obligations to notify the Australian Commissioner for Law Enforcement Integrity, the ACLEI, of corruption issues involving its law enforcement activities. New policies relating to approving and signing off expenses, building a centralised breach reporting register for staff to manage conflicts, and finalising review of potential procurement breaches. ASIC has already adopted one key recommendation of the 2015 Capability Review, which was to appoint a senior officer to step down and perform the functions in a head office role. In this role, Mr. Warren Day will have responsibility for management of operational aspects of ASIC's activities. He said this will free up the Commission to focus on regulatory and enforcement decision-making, key strategic issues, external relations and communication. The key message was ASIC is a proactive regulator, not reactive, a novel concept given its track record, she says. But reactive regulators have been a recurring theme in this country. It was a criticism also levelled at Australia's financial crimes watchdog, AUSTRAC, earlier on Friday, when Senator Deborah O'Neill lobbed a series of questions at two officers about its capacity to have oversight on money laundering breaches. What became clear from her questions is that the regulator has a lot of gaps to fill in bringing it in line with global counterparts, including New Zealand. The first relates to the number of entities in its orbit due to a government failure to amend the Anti-Money Laundering and Counter-Terrorism Financing Act to include industries such as real estate, fine art, jewellery, as well as so-called gatekeeper professions such as lawyers and accountants. If introduced, it would expand the number of entities required to register with AUSTRAC as a reporting industry from 15,000 to more than 100,000. These industries would be obliged to report any suspicious activity or cash transactions over $10,000 to AUSTRAC. Until they do, crooks will be able to exploit the booming real estate market and the absence of anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing in real estate and launder money by buying high-value properties. In relation to gateway professions such as lawyers, the Panama Papers leaked in 2016 showed how a law firm can facilitate various money laundering schemes to enable billions of dollars to slip through undetected until the leak. Shortly after the Panama Papers scandal, the government launched a feasibility study to investigate widening AUSTRAC's net. It then announced plans to update the Act, but that was in 2018, and since then there has been little movement. As we saw from the Westpac money laundering scandal, the risks are real. The bank received a record fine after being caught breaching AML laws more than 23 million times, including allowing customers to transfer money to the Philippines for the purpose of child exploitation. At least one of those customers made 625 transactions between 2013 and 19, including transferring money to a person in the Philippines who was arrested in 2015 for child trafficking and live streaming of child sex shows and selling child sex. O'Neill pointed to another case mentioned in the Financial Action Task Force, an Egmont Group report in December 2020, that didn't attract any fines despite banks being involved. It states that in 2017, the Australian Border Force found that more than $500 million had passed through Australian bank accounts since 2014 after it was referred from an international partner. Upon further reading, the $500 million was the proceeds of crime for South American cocaine cartels. The criminal proceeds were transmitted to bank accounts in Southeast Asia before they were subsequently layered through a multitude of Australian bank accounts. The proceeds were remitted to offshore bank accounts or used to purchase small high-end electronic devices for export to companies in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. The undervaluation of exported devices exaggerated the illicit value being transferred offshore, the report said. AUSTRAC did a great job pinging Westpac, Commonwealth Bank and Tabcorp for rampant breaches of the Act. It was a huge win. And in the case of Westpac, the $1.3 billion fine was the largest anti-money laundering penalty ever handed out outside of the US. But when it comes to the gambling sector, AUSTRAC has been a massive disappointment. In 2017, it conducted a casino junket campaign with a finding that casinos are broadly aware of and complying with their anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing act obligations regarding casino junkets. For years, there have been reports of systemic money launderings at Crown Resorts, including an ABC Four Corners expose back in 2017. Then in 2019, a joint venture with the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and 60 Minutes revealed Crown had links to Chinese crime bosses, drug syndicates, money laundering, and alleged sex trafficking rings. It took AUSTRAC until October 2020 to finally launch an inquiry. This was after the New South Wales casino regulator ventilated the issues in a very public, high-profile inquiry through 2020. When asked about how many other companies it was investigating, AUSTRAC declined to respond, taking regulatory opaqueness to a whole new level. And that really is the point. Whether you look at RBA, whether you look at ASIC, whether you look at APRA or AUSTRAC, there is a considerable body of evidence that they are not fully effective, and yet the government seems not at all concerned. And that in itself is a worry. And so to the local markets. The ASX 100 closed down 0.61% to 5,519. The ASX 200 closed down 0.56% to 6,708. The Financial Services Index fell 0.31% to 6,043. And the Real Estate Trusts rose 0.78% to 1,390. The Local Volatility Index rose 9.95% to 1,375. and the S&P ASX 200 futures fell 0.1% to 6,664. Amongst the banks, ANZ was up 0.32% to 28.23. CBA was down 1.21% to 84.71. NAB was down 0.31% to 25.93. And Westpac was up 0.33% to 24.52. Amongst the regionals, the Bank of Queensland was at 8.49. Bendigo was up 0.83% to 9.68. Suncorp was up 0.3% to 10.13. And Macquarie Group was down 1.74% to 148.80. AMP was down 0.35%, 1.41. And Genworth was down 0.39% to 2.58. McGrath was up 0.79% to 64 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was up 1.11% to 9.1 cents. AFG was down 3.83% to 2.51. And Mortgage Choice was up 0.85% to 1.18. Afterpay was down 2.43% to 108.30 in the week that CBA announced they were going to launch an Afterpay equivalent on their platform. CIMAC was down 2.53% to 18.12. And the Aussie US dollar was down 0.17% to 77.43. The Euro Aussie dollar was up 0.18% to 1.5378. And amongst bonds, the 2-year bond was down 14.76% to 0.104. The 3-year was down 10.17% to 0.106, but again, we see quite a lot of volatility there. And the 10-year bond was up 2.21% to 1.848. The gold Aussie cross was up 0.74% to 2,253, while the Bitcoin Aussie cross was up 0.93% to 75,737. And so in summary, we expect to see the bond markets continuing to motor a little higher, but probably not as fast with the SLR issue put on the back burner. But nevertheless, there are still a number of uncertainties in the markets. And as I discussed with Tarek Brooker the other day, we are seeing a number of different scenarios, some positive, some less positive, playing out. And that leads to Schrödinger's economy. And by the way, on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time, I'll be joined by Damien Klassen, and he's going to discuss the latest on the markets, and that will be a really interesting discussion, of course, given everything that's going on, and you can ask a question live via the YouTube chat. So mark your diaries and join us at 8 p.m. Sydney on Tuesday. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.